Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. Her name is Ivy Zelman, and I have been following her research and writing for the better part of a decade plus. She has had a series of phenomenal calls within various aspects of the real estate industry, be it the home builders, the mortgage originators, the credit underwriters. She is definitely a contrarian. She is somebody who is extremely astute as to the economic cycle and how it affects housing. If you are at all interested in real estate, credit, homes, both single family and multifamily, and all of the latest innovations in either technology or financial innovations and financing of especially from the private equity side, we just spent some time talking about iBuying, the instantaneous buyers that have appeared that facilitate transactions of sellers. I think you're going to find this conversation filled with wonky goodness. So with no further delay, my conversation with real estate and equity analyst expert, Ivy Zelman. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest this week is Ivy Zelman. She is the CEO and founder of Zelman & Associates, a boutique research firm focusing exclusively on the housing industry. She is an institutional investor, Hall of Fame equity analyst. The All-American Research Team rankings placed Ivy and her team with 11 first-place rankings between 1999 and 2013. Ivy Zelman, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thank you for having me, Barry.
So you cover one of my very favorite areas because it's so fascinating, especially in the United States. Housing, the pursuit, construction, financing of it. Let's talk about the early days of your career and how you became a housing analyst. You began on Wall Street in 1990, is that about right?
That's right.
What path led you there?
Well, actually, I didn't start out interested in housing, admittedly. I was really focused as an undergrad on accounting, and I was working at Arthur Young, now Ernst & Young, going to night school. So I went to undergrad for 6 years, and during the time that I was studying at George Mason University and working at Ernst & Young as an accounting major, I was asking a lot of these accountants that I worked with, do you like what you do? And they hated it. They almost universally, everyone I talked with said, you don't want to be an accountant. So I was like, well, what should I do? And they basically all said, go get a job on Wall Street. And I'm like, what does that mean? Because at George Mason, Wall Street firms didn't recruit students there. So I had to network and knock on doors. And eventually it led me to Wall Street, where I got a job at Salomon Brothers in investment banking. And I was there for a 2-year stint as an investment banking analyst prior to going into equity research and housing.
So all told, you were there from 1990 to 1997.
Right.
Is that about right?
Yep.
Kind of overlapping with the Michael Lewis Liar's Poker era.
Right. One of my favorite books, by the way.
So that is a very much a male-dominated period in Wall Street. Not that Wall Street has really done enough to even the gender levels, but back in the 90s, that had to be kind of a wild place to work.
It was a lot of fun. I think starting out, first being in a class, because I was in a training program. I think I was one of three women of 70 kids. And we were all there for 2 years. I was intimidated because most of them were from the Ivy League. And so I initially, not even being just a woman, but just, you know, having from a state university. But, you know, once you're there, you know, you put your head down, you work hard. And it was really just about proving myself and as working hard as I can. So I think that it today, I look back on that time and I had a lot of fun. But it was about just, you know, execution and working as hard as you can to prove yourself.
So how did you transition from investment banking analyst to housing analyst?
After 2 years, you're out of a job, which you know that's the case when you took the job.
It's a two-year lifespan.
It's a two-year lifespan. And most of the 70-odd plus or minus will go on to get their MBA and then return, you know, back to Wall Street. And because I had student loans already through undergrad and unfortunately didn't want to take on the responsibility or go back to school after 6 years, I just was looking for a job to pay my rent. And internally, we had something called the Treasury scandal going on at that time. And unfortunately, John Goodfriend and the firm was in turmoil. So a lot
of
people...
Is this the period where Warren Buffett came in and righted the ship? Okay.
Pretty much. And prior to Warren Buffett righting the ship, the view was the lights were going to go out at Salomon. And
oh, really?
A lot of people were leaving. And there was an opportunity that opened up in equity research in the housing space and actually in corporate finance. I worked in transportation group. And gentleman by the name of Julius Maldudis, which is a famous airline analyst, he's like, you should go work in equity research, you know, and go help them. So I got a job with his recommendation as an associate in the, at that time, it was Bruce Harding, who covered SNLs and Fannie and Freddie, and he was picking up home building and housing as a favor because Bob Bishop quit, said, I'm out of here, as many other people were quitting. Mm-hmm. So I came an associate, and I was just happy to have a job. People were like, you don't want to be an equity research analyst. They're just like monkeys. The companies tell them what to write. And I just wanted to get a job and stay at the firm, and there you have it.
To be fair, some of them are not monkeys. Some of them are insightful researchers who put forth intelligent, actionable, wealth-generating research.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. And I certainly don't agree with the monkey comment, but it was the beginning of now my nearly 30-year career as an equity analyst.
So not as a monkey, but
not as a monkey,
but actually generating research. So you're kind of thrown into housing. How did you suddenly discover such a proficiency for it? What made you so astute as someone without a background in housing going into that space?
You know, I think what I really loved about it initially was the fact the challenge was to really find ways to differentiate the work that I was doing. And when you have a fragmented industry, and housing is something that, you know, I could relate to, I lived in a home, I liked the housing market. It was really about finding companies that were privately held, mm-hmm. that are in the business of housing, whether they were a home builder or a realtor like your mom or a building product manufacturer, and talking to them about the business and learning from them, and then using that analysis to then try to correlate or predict what public companies would do.
Were other people delving into private companies at that time as a way to give them a little more color into what the reality of the public corporate situation was?
Not that much, to be honest with you. In fact, not to give too much credit to any one person, but it was really, I was assigned a buddy. Salomon Brothers decided that a salesperson and analyst would become buddies, and they would work closely together for the younger analyst to learn from the senior salesperson. And this senior salesperson really said, you know, you need to go dig in the channel. You need to find private companies. And that was really the direction I went. Now, it just so happened I happened to have married my buddy, but that's a longer story. But my husband, David, really was the one who directed me to go find private companies, and that will really help differentiate you.
Huh, quite fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about Wall Street and housing. I think for the most part, Wall Street has not done a distinguished job covering housing in general, covering the retail and department store sector, certainly the credit companies that are associated with residential housing. what's your view? Is Wall Street, am I overstating this, or does Wall Street not do a great job getting housing right?
Well, you know, looking at really our firm, which we think we do get it right, you know, what we've built has enabled us to really differentiate our overall views, because we're dependent not upon what economists are predicting or other outside parties' perspectives, meaning publicly traded management teams telling them what they should do. We're really going outside through our own network, which again, we channel check, develop relationships. We have nearly 1,000 companies that are throughout what I call the housing ecosystem, whether they're a builder, they're a broker, they're a mortgage originator, they're a manufacturing company that makes building products, or they're in the single family rental business as an owner operator, apartment. We're taking all of these silos and we're aggregating data that is proprietary data within each silo, and we're then triangulating it amongst this ecosystem to have a firm view of what's going on in the market. And I don't think it's unique to Zelman. No one else has anything like what we do. And it's been built over the course of the decades that I've been in the business. So I can't say what other firms do, but I think we get it right.
Well, it sounds like Wall Street is generally a little too close with corporate management and they're looking for guidance and not doing a sort of deep outside-the-box research dive into various aspects of housing, or again, am I overstating that?
Well, again, I can't speak on behalf of what other firms are doing, but I know what we don't do. And I can tell you that back in the, I guess, go-go days of the housing market in, you know, 03, 04, 05, I wasn't a very popular analyst working at Credit Suisse when I was negative, and certainly the companies didn't see eye to eye with my views. And it's like being the sober person at the party. I was definitely a lone ranger at times.
So let's talk about that period. Financial engineering was endemic. Securitization was a giant revenue source. And we ended up seeing that eventually spiral out of control into the great financial crisis. So what is it about that era that led so many people astray, especially the supposed smart guys doing the quantitative research?
Well, I don't know that you could pin it on one thing other than greed. Certainly the inability to really take sort of the entire mosaic and see the risk that was so, in our opinion, obvious. A lot of people started, I call it, drinking their own Kool-Aid and believing that there was a secular shift in homeownership rates and that the government was certainly supportive of continued, you know, enabling people to have the American dream. But there was a optimism that was not supported by the, you know, ingredients that go into, you know, creating that opportunity for people. So it just was a, again, as if people just were convinced that it was different this time and that, you know, housing was, you know, going to go up forever.
So I want to point out, this is not a case of hindsight bias where, of course, the risks were obvious, says everybody today. In real time, I recall reading some of your research, 04, 05, 06. When did you leave? 07?
May of 07.
So in real time, before the bust, you were effectively saying there's a problem with credit, there's a problem with housing, this is unsustainable. What was the research that you were putting out at that time saying? How blunt were you?
Pretty blunt. I remember a report that we entitled Investors Gone Wild in July of 2005. Mm-hmm. I think we had like 1,000 people on our conference call across all of beyond equities within, you know, fixed income and derivatives everywhere. The securitization guys were there. But generally speaking, the amount of investors, when you go to, let's say, Las Vegas and you're driving from the airport and your taxi driver is telling you he's buying houses, and then, you know, you go to the nail salon and the woman in the nail salon is doing your nails is buying houses, and you realize we have a problem. I think that the investors and the magnitude that were buying both new and existing homes with no money down and understanding the mortgage piece was probably one of the biggest parts of our conviction on why we had a real problem here, and mentioning again affordability was clearly way out of reach from any historical perspective. The other aspect of it, besides investors gone wild, was the amount that the builders were willing to pay for land, and having the ability to talk to private companies and who would be competing with the builder for that land. And the private builders would tell us, oh my God, you cannot believe what these guys are paying for the land. That was another part of our analysis that really led us to understand the risks that these companies were really willing to absorb at the expense of shareholders.
You put your finger on a couple of things I want to bring up, one of which is historically, most builders are pretty cognizant of the real estate cycle and the business cycle. And they get aggressive when things are cheap, and when things get expensive, they pull back. But for some reason, it seemed that a lot of people sort of stopped doing that in 05, 06, 07. What was it about that period that made them forget, oh, no, we don't want to pay up for land. It'll come back down when the cycle turns.
Well, you know, I think there was a view that the demographics had shifted and that there was support for, you know, a secular growth in housing that we hadn't seen in prior cycles. That was what the companies pitched to the investment community, and they really believed it, many of them. They also had Wall Street pushing hard to drive top line. So what had been matching short-term assets with short-term debt or long-term debt with long-term assets, you know, what you started seeing is builders willingly taking on more leverage, buying larger parcels because it would feed the machine, enabling them to continue to show strong growth. Mm-hmm. And so the market was really demanding growth, and they were willing to put the capital to work. You know, it's one of the only businesses that, you know, once you build the factory and then sell it, you have to rebuild your factory. And unfortunately, this is a factory that, you know, you have to invest 50 cents to 70 cents to make a dollar of revenue. It's a capital intense business. And you start buying land that won't be, let's say, put into the manufacturing capacity utilization machine for a few years, you can really put some significant risk on the balance sheet.
Quite interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the timing of the launch of Zelman & Associates. You do this, was it later in 07? Is that right?
We left Credit Suisse in May and started Zelman October 3rd, 2007.
Okay, so October 5th, 2007.
October 3rd. Oh, sorry.
No, October 5th, 2007 is when the equity markets peaked and would not see that level again until 2013. So your timing was kind of interesting and coincidental. You obviously saw some variation of what was coming. Why launch into that sort of mayhem? Or was the expectation, hey, nobody's job is safe, we might as well do it ourselves? Or what were you thinking?
Well, my team at Credit Suisse, Dennis McGill, who was my partner, associate, and he's the co-founder of Zelman Associates, along with Alan Ratner, who was also working with us on the team at Credit Suisse. We were working as equity analysts, really focused on housing, but we were servicing the entire firm because we were such in the eye of the storm.
Right.
And we had such a controversial call. And I had such an unbelievable network that we created through these private industry contacts that we weren't feeling that we were first of all, we were unfortunately, a lot of people internally within the sales force and the traders and in the securitization, the ABS guys, they didn't agree with our call. Mm-hmm. So we were a little bit...
Hey, somebody has to be on the wrong side of the trade, right?
Well, we were not very popular. And, you know, I was even told by the head of product management from Credit Suisse's perspective that your job could be at risk if you don't make, you know, you had your... I think in 2006, this is what happened. 2006, the stocks were down about 40%. Mm-hmm. And there was a slowing. And we were right. And then Bob Toll and Toll Brothers said, hey, things are picking up. This is back in September of 06. And they called it the Zelman bottom. and that you need to get with it and you need to be more bullish. You've had your little good time now. Now you need to turn around and be bullish. And I remember publishing, Dennis and I, we had fun writing this report. In December of 2006, we wrote 10 reasons to sell home building stocks.
Wait, let's just make sure I understand the timing here. So you're negative on home builders and housing stocks. They fall 40% over the next 24 months. Is that fair?
I think that it was July of 2005 was when we started really seeing inventory starting to lift.
So 12 months.
Let's say 12 months.
So this is a fierce bear market, and it's only the beginning, down 40%. And somebody, not your direct boss, but somebody in the firm says, all right, you've had your little fun, you've had your little pullback, you better flip bullish. And your contrarian response is, bullish, watch this.
Right.
No hesitation, not wondering about, hey, these guys can get me fired. There was no thought about that. Or was there?
Well, this was a managing director running all of the morning call product manager, and I was pretty pissed off and actually went to my director of research and complained. And actually, the research director was very supportive of me. And so with that, they were great to me. Uh-huh. But this particular person, unfortunately, you know, was someone I was pretty upset with. But subsequent to that, sort of the Zelman bottom, we published something in October of 2006 called Wonderland.
Uh-huh.
And Wonderland was basically saying that the home building industry is going to have to write off equity because they've overpaid for so much land. We actually estimated about a 20% equity write-off.
How much was that in actual dollars?
We're talking
billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah, and in actuality, it turned out to be 50 to 60% that they wrote off.
Wow.
So we were way off, but we were so contrarian
right.
at this time. So that
nobody
was
else was saying 20% write-off.
No,
and
no
it
write-offs.
Out to be
no,
triple
no,
that.
Yeah, no write-offs or anything. So that was October of 2006. That was another sort of flagship report. But in December, the stocks kept going up. So they were rallying in our face. We're getting a lot of backlash. Salesforce was against us. People internally were like, what's the story? And in December, we came out with the 10 reasons to sell home building stocks. And
give us a few reasons out of the 10.
The 10 was they were, you know, basically the mortgage market was not sustainable. The fueling of the growth was coming from, you know, these ridiculous exotic mortgage products. You had land prices were going to crash. We had consumers that were not buying because the investors were buying. I'd have to go back and look at all the specifics. But
any big clients say, I don't care about that this is contrarian. I'm going to do this. And put giant bets to work?
Sure. John Paulson was one of our clients that we talked to regularly. Steve Eisman was one of my buddies. I probably spoke with him daily, along with his team, Danny Moses and Vinny Daniels. Those guys were, every day we were on the phone with them. There were some people that were really convinced, as we were, that this bearish call at some point was going to work.
So the Selma Gomez character in The Big Short, that was supposed to be you, is that right?
I got one quote in there, but not that one.
You did? What was the quote in The Big Short?
Oh, I don't remember the quote, but Mike Lewis did stick me in there.
You mentioned the cab driver in Vegas on the way back from the airport. My favorite scene with Steve Carell is I don't remember if it was a stripper or a waitress, but it was in a strip club. And he's asking her, they're talking about real estate. And he's saying, how do you afford the mortgage on that house? And she goes, that house, I have four houses. And that's the moment where, okay, I think I have to. Right. I don't remember what character he was, who he was playing in real life.
He was playing Steve Eisman.
He was Steve Eisman. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
yep.
That character,
absolutely.
That's the moment. It's a little more dramatic in a strip club than speaking to a Wall Street analyst about
housing. Actually, my husband and I, we owned a home in Florida, and uh-huh. we'd go out to the beach, and it's in a community, and the guy that was putting the umbrellas in the sand, Chris, he told my husband that he owned about 10, 15 lots, and I was like, and this is probably 2004, 2005, and he was asking my husband, do you want to go look at some lots with me, because you can buy them with no money down? And I was like, I'm like, David, do you hear this? This is crazy. So, you know, everywhere, you know, but Steve was on it. He had the call. He really did.
So a friend of mine called that era the so-called homeowners were really renters with an option to default, which I thought was kind of amusing.
Yeah, interesting.
Let's talk a little bit about where we are in the housing market today. I've seen a couple of things that remind me a little bit of the early 2000s. HGTV is going strong, and Flip This House is back. And although these days it seems to be more about renovating than it is about buying and selling them. But the housing market seems to have mostly recovered in about half the country. I'm ballparking that. Where do you see the housing market today? And does it remind you at all of the bad old days?
I think the housing market right now is pretty healthy. 2018 was a tough year. The market decelerated pretty much most of the year, more month to month, worse than normal seasonality. But by the time we got to the end of the year, it ended with a big thud. And a lot of people thought housing was going to lead us into a recession again, mainly due to the stock market turmoil, getting the political turmoil, the global uncertainties, sort of perfect storm. So housing came to kind of a screeching halt. And yet the fundamentals actually were pretty favorable. We have strong job growth, consumer confidence is high, and incomes are accelerating. And if you look at the housing market from supply and demand, we actually have a pretty significant deficit of a lack of supply, which we estimate to be about 25%. So when you just look at what we need in order to provide shelter for the incremental households growing and those getting knocked down and demolished, that's a pretty strong positive part of the thesis. Now, you mentioned half the market for the United States recovered. That's in terms of home prices.
Mm-hmm.
So about half the country is actually below its prior peak. As you think about pricing, the pricing in the housing market is a little bit now more challenging. So builders are, in fact, and brokers and real estate agents are seeing a momentum in spring pick back up from the thud. Now was the stock market close to record highs again. The political turmoil has settled down. But spring selling season actually is definitely pretty good. Now, the entry level is much stronger than the move up and luxury. And depending on a market where job growth might be stronger versus another city where it's not as strong, so all real estate, it doesn't necessarily move in tandem.
Right.
But right now, I'd say it's healthy and affordability is still reasonable. I don't see a lot of concerns at this point. Things that we're watching, I'm happy to elaborate, but generally, I'd say we feel pretty good about the market today.
So we have constrained supply, relatively low rates, even after the past year of increases. Rates are still historically, what is a mortgage today? 4%?
4.5%? 4.25%.
I mean, that's pretty reasonable, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
So given the limited supply and low rates, what does that mean for home prices over the next couple of years?
Well, home prices have been up. The first year they increased was 2012. And since 2012, we've been running at about a 5 to 6% growth CAGR. And what we're seeing right now is some moderation in home price appreciation. You know, the inventory is available for sale in the United States. If you look at it over a long period of time and we look at it, inventory, those homes listed for sale as a percent of households, which we think it provides a trend line, unlike
right.
most realtors and your mom probably talked about month supply.
Right.
What we tell you is that inventories in the U.S. are actually at 30-year lows. So inventories nationally are very, very low. And what that means is that there is more demand than supply. So prices continue to increase, but we're starting to see some moderation in how much pricing power there really is. More of that being skewed to more challenging environment at the higher end. Some cities, for example, in the luxury price point are actually seeing pretty significant deflation, like New York City, Miami, and others are just challenged, and sellers need to capitulate, especially on older stock that's boxy or, you know, dated, that needs to be rehabbed and hasn't been. So there's sellers need to be more realistic.
What about the ultra high end? My friend, we both know Jonathan Miller. He calls that aspirational pricing, when people slap a $40 or $50 or $100 million price tag on something that's really worth a fraction of it. What's happening with the ultra high end of the market? Is that finding a little reality, or do we still see crazy prices?
I think the markets in general are still seeing crazy prices. There has been some capitulation where sellers in Greenwich, for example, are starting to recognize it's been 3 years, the home's not moving, let me lower the price a bit. So we do see some, capitulation, but not nearly as much as we need to. In fact, yesterday I was with a client visiting in New York, and that when are New York City prices going to go down more? And I said, well, they've come down quite a bit from their aspirational peak, like Jonathan likes to say, from 2014. He says developers aren't willing to lower their prices. They're giving me 10 years of no maintenance and no taxes, but they won't lower the price. I said, stay tuned. They will.
You think that'll eventually, they'll be forced to?
I think they have to. I think right. Otherwise there might be distress for some of these developers. I mean, the sales for the luxury in New York City in the first quarter is like non-existent.
Really?
It's very, very weak.
So what about the fat part of the distribution of housing? The, let's call it half a million to $1 million homes, more than start. And by the way, that's my New York bias price. Or San Francisco, or Chicago is more reasonable. Lots of places in the rest of the country are more reasonable. But more than a starter home, less than the really high-end houses. How is that area doing?
It's really more market-dependent. Mm-hmm. You know, I could tell you in Dallas, for example, over 400,000 to 600,000, it's very competitive. Mm-hmm. And you're probably seeing a little pressure there. Builders being forced to use more concessions, whereas if you go into, let's say, a market like Phoenix, the 4 to 6 is very healthy, and you might even see some pricing power. So generally that segment of the market is been more, mature in terms of the cycle. And when you think back to 2011 was the bottom. So as we saw growth, really the fat of the market really has had now 7-8 years recovery. Mm-hmm. Whereas the entry level, believe it or not, the builders did not want to build that true affordable product, where we call it, you know, building out in the exurbs, the right. Pioneers, where you'd have to drive to qualify. Part of which was because the mentality was that consumers only want to walk to work. And or you can't get a mortgage. Now the mortgage market was so tight, builders were concerned about building affordable for lower credit quality. So really the entry level, true entry level price point didn't start getting constructed until really in earnest until 2016. In fact, we would argue that today the entry level portion of new home sales is still materially below where it what would be perceived normal. So it's a bit of a tale of two markets, where you have one meat of the market, mm-hmm. still has some legs, but it's later stage, and it's still reasonable, healthy in terms of inventories. It's still the 6 months, if that's a balanced market, the move up is still below 6 months. But you are seeing the low end, the entry level, where there's real robust demand, but just not enough product.
Huh. Quite interesting. What you mentioned how regional real estate is. What areas stand out, either for good or bad reasons, as interesting or unusual around the country?
I was just in Nashville last week, and I was just unbelievable booming market with, you know, really a pro-business stance that, you know, companies continue to move there and the migration's moving there. But just top of mind, because having just been there, we were there, I was speaking as a guest for a real estate conference, and I was sort of blown away by the growth. What we're seeing a lot, though, we study the markets, and we understand where migration patterns, importantly, which states are winning and which are losing. And Florida is just a winner, both with...
Across the board.
Millennials and with the boomers.
Right.
And you're seeing a tremendous amount of migration into Florida. And despite Miami Beach's softness right now at the higher price point, I think Florida is going to continue to be a winner. You continue to see winners out west and the southwest, strength in Vegas, Arizona, and Colorado. California, on the other hand, is where we see some concern. And we've lost foreign national buyers there. The foreign national Chinese buyers pretty much all but gone. Mm-hmm. People that are there, Chinese buyers are buying, but the foreign nationals have gone. The Bay Area, despite Silicon Valley and, you know, the benefits there, seems to be just not reaccelerating like the rest of California off of what was the weaker period of 18. And some of that, is it related to tax reform, SALT? Is it concern just in terms of the continued pressure on consumers?
Literally my next question. So we keep reading about the egress from New York to Florida and from California to Arizona. And I know some of that is just normal retirement. Hey, at a certain age, If you live in Westchester on Long Island, you may not want to go to Florida, but it's the law. You have to move down there. But, you know, the David Tepper story, leaving New Jersey because it saved him a bajillion dollars in taxes. How significant are those most recent tax changes and the loss of the state and local tax deduction to the real estate market?
Well, first you have to look at it in totality and appreciate that about 84% of tax filers actually had a reduction in the taxes that they pay.
Right.
So really,
but that's on a gross number. Is it a big deduction? Is it a little deduction? You mean after all the state and local?
If you took everything into consideration,
gotcha.
The benefit is actually, the majority actually had a benefit. Now,
right.
Where the negative impact is at the higher price or the higher income brackets.
Mm-hmm.
So where the risk would be is for that 80 to 85th percentile income percentile.
Right.
So where if you're in the highest income bracket, but really the question will be if you assumingly are in, let's say, Rye, New York or Scarsdale, or you're living out in Long Island and your kids are in high school or your kids are in elementary school, are you really picking up where you work and leaving the state because of taxes? No. You know, could you start to see some pricing pressure? Because maybe my buddy and his wife that are empty nesters and they can, you know, everybody's mobile today with today's technology, can work from their home. They're going to pick up and leave. So you're going to see more inventory start to build for that marginal person that can leave that will put some more pressure on prices. So I think the lever is price.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think that it will create a collapse, but I think the coastal sort of tri-state area, California markets are going to see some more incremental inventory lead to moderation in pricing.
Quite interesting. Can you stick around a bit? I have a ton more questions for
you.
We have been speaking with Ivy Zelman, CEO and co-founder of Zelman Associates. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and come back for the podcast extras where we keep the tape running and continue discussing all things real estate. You can find that wherever finer podcasts are sold, Apple, Stitcher, Overcast, Bloomberg.com. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at MIBpodcast@Bloomberg.net. You could check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com/opinion. Follow me on Twitter @Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Welcome to the podcast. Ivy, thank you so much for doing this. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I am a real estate junkie, not only because it was dinner table conversation every night back in the days when mortgage rates were 15%, but it's just fascinating. Everybody has to live somewhere. Why not live someplace fun, interesting, neat in a house that is... sort of representative of your style and tastes and values and interests, and it's really a fascinating space. You have to be thrilled that you found your way into real estate, even though that was never your intention when you began.
I am. I'm thrilled. I love it.
So let's go through a few of the questions we missed during the broadcast section before we get to our favorite questions in a few minutes. I have to ask about the launch of Zelman & Associates. So October 07, we were talking about the date. You said you launched October 3rd. I believe October 5th was the all-time high back then. at least for the Dow. What was it like launching right into the teeth of the rollover and slide down for the next 18 months?
Well, my partner and I, Dennis McGill, we recruited our partners in crime at Credit Suisse, Alan Ratner, mm-hmm. and Melinda Greenwich, who was my secretary at the time, kind of pulled her over from Credit Suisse. And my husband was also in the beginning. So it was really the five of us. And it was 24/7. We were working our butts off in order to be prepared for our big date that we set. But I think it was so much fun as well, because we, at this point, had already had tastes of victory, mm-hmm. where we knew that what we had predicted was actually not only coming to fruition, but way worse than we had ever considered or predicted. And so while we were in the teeth of the storm, with not, you know, clear certainty which direction and how much more severe the storm could be, we had just a fantastic time circling investors and interest. We were in the sweet spot, so it was so much fun. I mean, we had crazy days and nights, and it was all consuming. I could tell you that it was difficult with three little babies running around, but it was like where you'd wake up at 4 a.m. and you just couldn't wait to get in front of your computer. So it was just thrilling, really thrilling.
So I remember, I want to do get the years right. I could be doing my memory could be faulty. In I think it was 2005, the home builders rolled over, and I don't remember if that was 40% that year, but it was clear they were under stress while the rest of the market was going higher. And then the next year, the banks and brokers, 06, started to come under pressure. And again, the market kept going up. And then 07, I don't remember what segment rolled over.
It was New Century.
Is that what it was?
March of 07.
So New mortgage Century. Underwriter.
Right.
So so was the mortgage underwriters in 07, and the market kept going up. So when you're launching the firm, these are three calls that you had previously talked about as a contrarian, as an outlier, who turned out to be correct. When you launched the firm, I have to assume a lot of clients came along with you.
Fortunately, they did.
So
it was a very strong launch, and you know, we have had the ability to continue to recruit new clients and really provide what we think is unique proprietary research that no one else no one else on Wall Street does anything like we do. So we really provide significant advantages to our institutional investors and private equity firms that use Zelman.
So private equity are also clients?
Yeah, mostly it's hedge funds and mutual funds, but we also have some private equity clients as well.
So let's talk a little bit about that network. How do you go about, because the only thing I can even remotely compare it to, in the early days, Ed Hyman started on an economic side, building out a network of private companies that would report their data to him. And basically, part of the reason he was so successful in the economic space as a non-economist is his data was better than what BLS was generating.
Right.
Sounds like you created something similar within the real estate space. Builders, brokers, real estate, developers, who else was in that network? And how do you go about reaching out to these folks?
So we do follow Ed's model in going after sort of understanding what is happening in various silos within the economy, but ours is dedicated just to housing and housing related. But so we've got a survey of private home builders, mm-hmm. a survey of land developers, a quarterly survey for banks to discuss their lending to acquisition and development financing for builders. We have a apartment survey, a building product manufacturing distribution survey. We just published that today. Single family rental and a home center survey. We just published that one as well today. I'm sure I'm going to forget one. The broker survey, mm-hmm. which we survey about 10% of existing home sales. So if you look at each silo, the home building survey is the most mature and most significant probably in sample size. I forgot the mortgage originator survey, mm-hmm. which is also very significant in size. But all of them, we have not to discount what Ed's survey does, but Ed has very few questions. Most of the surveys we have, will be anywhere from 20 to 30 questions.
So how do you reach out to somebody and say, hey, listen, I want you to participate in a quarterly thing? Don't worry, it's only 8 pages of questions. It'll take you less than a week to fill it out. How do you make that pitch?
Well, first you go back 25, 30 years and you have a survey that's done over the phone and you build and cement relationships. And over time with technology, you create a platform where they can do it online. It's all automated. But the exchange with these C-suite executives that tallied at nearly 1,000 throughout the ecosystem is we will give you the research.
For free.
For free if you fill out the survey.
And everybody who participates wants to know what's happening in the adjacent silos. So that works out
well. They want to know what's going on within their peers, within their own silo.
Right.
But they want someone that can triangulate all of it. And in fact, our institutional investors are so data-driven that sometimes the C-suite executives, our information is almost too much for them, which is one of the reasons we developed a newsletter called the Z Report, which is a much higher level bi-monthly report that just gives you really that 30,000 foot perspective, 7 to 8 articles on all the pieces of the mosaic. Because some of them were like, Ivy, it's just too much. So they prefer that.
So when you say bi-monthly, it's every other month, not...
I'm saying bi-weekly.
Bi-weekly.
Sorry.
So twice a month, effectively.
Correct.
I never know which is which. That's why
I said bi-monthly, but it's twice a month.
So, and that... How big of a document is that? Is that something that can be read quickly?
I'd say you can read it in 10, 15 minutes, and it has some charts. But, you know, whether the articles are on, you know, rising healthcare costs as an impediment to home ownership or affordability, you know, reaching a new high or low, whatever the topic might be, on demographics, millennials, you know, accelerate family formation. We take each of the pieces of our puzzle, and we take articles that we think are timely, and it allows people, again, to walk away from a 10 to 15 minute read with hopefully a nice hot cup of tea or coffee with, wow, I really get what's going on now in the housing market overall.
Huh. That's very, very interesting. So if you want to express an idea in a trade, how do you go about doing it? Is it long or short the home builders, the credit side? How does... Do some of these hedge funds, we know what happened in 08 and 09, but how do hedge funds today take your research and apply it to capital?
Well, because we are an equity research firm, so our recommendations are to buy, hold, or sell equities, whether they're going to do something that's outside of the equities, we don't recommend. So we're strictly going to recommend whether they short or go long stocks. So that's all really the firm.
So what sort of stocks do you cover? Obviously the home builders are going to be one group, the mortgage originators are another. Do you go further afield to REITs or anything like that?
So we have home builders, building product manufacturers and distributors. We have real estate brokers. We follow Redfin, Zillow, Realogy, REMAX. We follow mortgage insurers, mortgage title companies, and mortgage tech.
Uh-huh.
We follow the home centers. We follow single family rental REITs and apartment REITs. And I think that's...
Do you do
everybody.
Office space or storage or retail?
No, we only do residential. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the, you know, I guess, way we think of our niche, that it has to be within residential.
So let me take you a little off of that niche a bit. There's a giant article in the Wall Street Journal about the big malls, how they continue to have some of their anchor stores going away. And then once that goes away, everybody else starts to fade and it becomes problematic. And there was some place, I'm going to get this wrong, I don't remember if it was Minneapolis or somewhere, where the mall essentially gets sold to a developer who raises it and now is putting in apartments, homes. It's a whole multi-use. So is there something worth tracking on the retail apocalypse side relative to housing, or is that just so distant and so far removed it's not worth paying close attention to?
Well, I think it makes sense to assume it's getting repurposed.
Uh-huh.
And as we think about shelter, really you have to think about it with the complete eyes with the complete view of rental as well as for sale. And so if it gets repurposed for sale or for rent in single family where we have a deficit, then we'll be able to track that through the land development survey that we're doing. And tracking that will enable us to see where the growth is going to be and whether or not the growth is justified. But today, if you look at shelter, we believe the multifamily market is actually above normal.
Meaning and there's plenty of supply of that.
It's above where it should be. In fact, there's, if you look at multifamily, five plus units, so multifamily high rise or generally, where the problem is predominantly urban core. Multifamily is at multi-decade highs with the amount of inventory in backlog. Whereas suburban is not as, let's say, problematic, but there's a real core urban is where the inventories for, we believe, multifamily market is actually significantly above normal.
So if we had a guess coming out of the crisis, people were either reluctant to buy or unable to qualify for a mortgage. So there was a ton of renters, and it seemed the builders went a little hog wild over there. Is it safe to assume that the pendulum is going to start swinging in the other direction? Or does this really have to, do they really have to run out the rope and see some problems before they adjust what they're building?
So if I understand your question correctly, you're asking, will the builders start to build affordable product again?
When will they shift from multifamily to single family if there's a plethora of multifamily and a dearth of single family?
Well, they're completely different operators, different developers, different operators from the perspective that they're within their silos. The multifamily operators would never just go do single family. Very unusual. You'll sometimes have, like Lennar Corporation is a publicly traded company, and they're known for their single family building, but they also have a multifamily business.
Right.
But very few organizations, companies have in the multifamily space do single family as well.
So when you really, what I'm wrestling with is if there's way too much multifamily builders, they're not going to say, hey, there's too much supply, let's take a year off.
Right.
Do they just keep building? Do they move towards luxury? What do they do in the face of excess supply?
Well, right now, what you'll start to see is that they have pressure on rents and their underwriting requirements, or what the way they underwrote the land, they won't be hitting their hurdle rates at some point if this supply that we believe is still in backlog actually gets delivered and pressures their returns. So right now, there's a lot of capital chasing this asset class because when you compare it to malls or other REITs, it's actually a tall midget in many respects.
Right, tallest midget in the group.
Right. Even though it's expensive, it's actually one of those very consistent businesses. It doesn't have the kind of cyclicality that the single family for sale market. So it's still a very good business. But what may happen from the supply being, in our opinion, at excess levels, is that they won't get the returns that they underwrote if rents start to come under pressure. We do think they get leased up. But the question is, will that spigot of growth start to slow as those lease rates come under pressure? That in itself will start to slow the growth.
And before I get to my favorite questions, any other things standing out within the residential real estate market that's unusual or interesting, be it regional or what are you kind of going, that's surprising?
Well, there's a few things. I could talk about the iBuyer market.
iBuyer being?
iBuyer. Today, we have companies that are offering consumers to buy their homes for cash within a few days. So instant buyer. And Open Door, which is a private company, is the leader in this business where at a discount to, they have an algorithm that basically will determine the price that they're willing to pay for a home, allowing that person to be able to move to a move-up home. And actually, Lennar was an investor in Open Door, and the reason they invested in Open Door's concept, and these guys are out of Silicon Valley, Eric Wu is the CEO, is because they found that a lot of our buyers can't sell their homes to move into our homes. So that was conceptually why they did it.
So what happens? Someone comes along and says, we'll pay you cash, theoretically, at a discount to...
Yeah, say let's 5-7% discount to what is retail.
Right. And then they'll turn around and sell it.
They'll put, with that money, they'll fix it up, and then they'll sell it. Now, Zillow's in the business now. Zillow Offer, Redfin Now, OfferPad, Knocked, it's really growing to be a very big business. In fact, Zillow, who we have a sell rating on, is actually changing their entire business model to go after this iBuyer market. So that's a big, interesting thing going on, generally speaking.
Professional flippers.
Yes, professional flippers.
Huh.
Another interesting thing that's going on is the build-to-rent market. So I mentioned that we have a deficit of housing, but not everyone can afford to buy a home. So what consumers want today, though, is they want the American dream. They want the backyard. They want their own home. But in many cases, they can't, for whatever reason, either get approved for a mortgage or they don't want to be committed. And they don't want it. They want to have flexibility. So the build-to-rent market is actually accelerating to help close the gap. And if you look at the build-for-rent market, it could be builders that are willing to sell the last few units in a phase to a build or a single-family rental operator. Or they, in fact, are keeping the asset themselves on the balance sheet and renting them out to generate cash flow. But I believe that the build-for-rent market will accelerate to become a bigger portion of today's household. So roughly 12% of the households in this country live in a single-family rental home.
Rental home, not a multifamily unit.
No, single-family rental.
Wow.
And one of the misnomers in the marketplace is that you either live in an apartment or you live in a single-family home. And what people don't appreciate is that if you just look at like living alone, do you have any idea how many people that live alone live in a single-family home? Forgetting if they rent it or own it, just a guess. What percent?
5%?
38%.
Really? That's a giant number.
That's a giant number.
Well, I guess if you start thinking about the older demographic, the second person, the survivor, once one of the husband and wife passes away, that's got to be a pretty hefty number. And then divorces, and then people who just want to own a house. But I would never have guessed that.
Well, keep in mind, we're not distinguishing between owning versus renting. So just 38%. So then when you think about lifestyle, if you go, okay, then roommates, then I get married, then I have children. By the time our data shows, by the time you're married with two children, 82% live in a single family home.
Wow.
And that, in fact, is, again, not distinguishing renting versus owning. But when you think about millennials today call them 75 million. I've got two millennials. They're young, 14, 16. Hi, Zoe and Zach. I got Zia, too. She's the youngest, but she's not a millennial. When you start to see these millennials actually get married or cohabitate and have families, they're in their early 30s right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's 75 million of them. We're just at the beginning of this wave of what will be an unbelievable tailwind for the demographics for the need for single family shelter, assuming you believe that people will continue to get married and have children. And we have some fun ways to analyze this. So we do some obviously studying birth rates. A lot of people see the national birth rate for the country is going down. But when you look at the 25 plus year old women, that birth rate has been growing at a very fast rate. We call it the good birth rate. Because nationally, birth rates are going down because teenage birth rates are down over 50% since 07.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing, right? So what we really look at, and I think it just to reiterate, it's about lifestyle. Lifestyle drives the need for shelter or changes in the type of shelter. So when we look at build for rent and we see that phenomena is a growing trend, I think that you'll hear more about it, and there's more Wall Street money contemplating it, and builders that are selling to the single family REITs and doing it themselves, the iBuyer market, and then just technology. The real estate industry is one that is being disrupted. If you think about, your mother as a real estate broker, it's a very, very tough time. They're being attacked from all angles.
Right. I mean, she's retired, but the days of 6% commissions, that's pretty much gone, right?
I think that certainly has yet to be eliminated, but there's a lot going on that can continue to pressure margin, pressure splits. The market is being disrupted from a lot of different angles.
Huh. Quite fascinating. So the firm is called Zelman & Associates. Is this really the Ivy Zelman show, or is it something else?
Actually, thank you for asking. No, this is not just the Ivy Zelman show. In fact, I've got probably close to 30 employees. We have about a dozen analysts. Each analyst is responsible for their silo and are very successful in aggregating data and analyzing the industry that they're responsible for. So it's really, I'm a small piece of what really Zelman Associates is, and there's a lot more of a strength behind the person you see sitting here. And whether it's Alan Ratner, our senior home building analyst, Justin Spear, these people work their tails off, and really appreciate all the work. And I get a lot of credit, but they're the power behind the firm.
So before I let you go, I have to get to my favorite 10 questions we ask all our guests.
Okay.
Sort of a speed round. Are you ready for this?
Ready.
Tell us the first car you ever owned, year, make, and model.
Toyota Corolla, 1980.
What's the most important thing we don't know about you?
That I live in Cleveland and I have three beautiful children and they are my life.
So you went over Cleveland pretty quickly. How do you like living in Cleveland?
Well, I admittedly went kicking and screaming, married a Cleveland boy who I met at Solomon Brothers, David.
Right.
But it's a wonderful place to raise a family. And I get to be with my husband's family all the time. And it's great for the kids. And if we could just get the sun to come out.
Yeah, the weather is not great in Cleveland, is
but
it?
But the Browns are supposed to be good this year. So
yes, they are supposed to.
We'll
so
see.
Tell us about your early mentors. Who affected the way you did analytics and thought about housing?
Well, I already credited David, my buddy at Solomon, but I have to say when you
buddy
think...
Buddy slash husband?
Yeah, his husband was later, but when you think about your life and the A-list of people I had the pleasure of working with, whether we're talking about people on the sell side at Credit Suisse and Solly, as well as all the clients that I've interacted with, you know, I can give you 10 people that come to mind off the top of my head, but one that really stands out is Melinda Greenwich, who was really my mentor early on in my career. She's my secretary. But she had been at Drexel, and she was with me for over 20 years and is a friend, business, family, life, every day. And she no longer works with me. Now Kim Gray is my mentor. And people think about mentor where you call someone up and, you know, you have a challenge, you want to talk something through. You know, these women are there for me through thick and thin, you know, call in the middle of the night. Those are the people that I want to highlight, the people that mean everything to me.
Quite interesting. What fill in the blank investors, analysts, managers helped shape your thinking about the housing market?
Give me your list again. Investors?
Could be anybody. Investors, strategists, analysts, economists. Who has influenced the way you approach the real estate market?
Well, it's so many. I think that builders themselves, a lot of the private builders in the market that really helped me to understand the business and give me from an unbiased perspective and their, you know, the quality of information and being able to absorb from the perspective of an open sort of whiteboard, the builders, the private builders, Bert Silva, who's a good friend and a CEO in the home building industry. I just learned a tremendous amount from him. In the investment world, you know, I think about today some of my top clients, certainly Richard Chilton at Chilton Advisors, learning about to go after the best in class managements and understand, you know, just a long term investing. There's an art to it, and it doesn't necessarily mean you day trade, and that there's ways to differentiate. Bob Bishop at Impala, who was originally Solomon Brothers Housing Analyst, who's now a client. He taught me a lot about the business. Ricky Sandler at Eminence Capital, who's someone I grew up with, but he was ahead of the curve from that versus where I was, taught me a lot about the business. So I can keep going.
No, that's a healthy list. So let me shift gears on you. What do you do for fun? What do you do when you're out of the office?
Well, I love to walk my beautiful Australian Shepherd, go for long walks, hike. I do a lot of puzzles. Jigsaw puzzles. I like the new wood puzzles. That's been my new thing. And I've been also doing brain games, which has been fun. And hanging out, watch the kids play sports. My daughter's a great soccer player, and she runs track, and she keeps us every weekend very busy. Oh, and my oldest is off to University of Miami, so hopefully I'll be there and seeing the sun more.
Yeah, that's right, in the winter. Tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from the experience.
Well, I would say that I was convinced I was going to be an investment banker, And I was going to Wall Street to be an investment banker, and I found that it wasn't the right fit for me, and I was pretty devastated. And what I learned from that experience was that your first job won't necessarily be your last, and that even though you're convinced you think you know what you are going to do with the rest of your life, you actually can evolve into something else and be successful. So for me, that's really the path that led me to where I am today.
So what has you most excited about what's going on in the real estate industry these days?
The uncertainty of what's next, from technology, from disruption, from sustainability. You know, it always is changing every day. What's, you know, unfortunately, a lot of it's dependent upon the economic backdrop, but there's a lot of interesting new things that are going on in our sectors. So we have to stay on top of them and obviously continue to guide our clients down the right path for where to steer their investments and sizing and getting out before the market turns is going to be the next goal.
So everybody's favorite question, tell us some of your favorite books, be they fiction, nonfiction, real estate related, or whatever.
Well, I've got eclectic, a number, but I enjoyed, and it was life-changing, a book called Thrive by Arianna Huffington.
Ah, okay. I remember when that came out.
And that was really impactful.
Life-changing.
Life-changing.
Wow.
From a person who worked 24/7 and learned a little more balance from thanks to Arianna. I read and loved Anna Quindlen's Plenty of Cake, Plenty of Candles, which really gave me a renewed optimism on aging.
Much better than the alternative.
Much better than the alternative. I can't help but mention Liar's Poker and The Big Short, one of my friends and favorite authors, Michael Lewis. All the Light You Cannot See by Anthony Doe, which is World War II fiction, but an incredible read if you like that period. And then just lastly, I read a lot because I'm a mother of teenage children, and Leonard Sachs, the books that he's written for parents, Girls on the Edge is a must read. And I'm a little bit anti-social media parent for children. And so I would recommend that highly for parents.
What sort of advice would you give to a millennial or someone interested in finance or real estate who is just beginning their career?
I think that everyone should find a mentor. Everyone should appreciate your first job isn't your last, and read a lot. I think for me, it was networking as well. I never stopped networking. I remember folding towels in a gym at 6 a.m. to pay for school, and I would talk to every gym member and ask them if they knew anybody. So network, network, network.
Our final question, what do you know about the world of real estate-related investing today that you wish you knew 25 or so years ago when you were first starting out?
Well, I wish I understood. I wish I had the benefit of hindsight and appreciating cycles and being willing to tolerate more risk, that there's opportunities and when there is disruption in the market to take advantage of it. I think I'm way too conservative, and I was way too risk-averse.
Makes perfect sense. We have been speaking with Ivy Zelman of Zelman & Associates. If you enjoy this conversation, well, look up An Inch or Down an Inch on Apple iTunes, and you can see any of the other 250 or so such conversations we've had over the previous 5 or so years. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Be sure and give us a review on Apple iTunes. We love your feedback, comments, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps put together these conversations each week. Medina Parwana is my producer / audio engineer. Michael Boyle is our booker. Michael Batnick is our head of research. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, We don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.